This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Later in the hour, we'll explore the future of batteries, a key to realizing the vision of a decarbonized, reliable grid. But first, weird weather is on everybody's mind, right? Unbelievable flooding in Germany, mudslides in Japan. Here, heat like we've never seen it before. And if you think about it, it's not just people feeling the heat. The wildlife are being affected too, in ways that you might not expect. Amy Nordstrom has been following the heat. She's here with that story and other science headlines this week. Amy is an editor at MIT's Technology Review. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, let's talk about this. So the consequences of heat on wildlife.
Yes. California's Department of Fish and Wildlife said this week that they're expecting almost all of the juvenile Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River in California to die this year because of the extreme heat that they've been dealing with.
All the salmon to die. Wow.
All the salmon. That's right. And this is a key time for salmon in that river. The adult salmon have come back to the river from the ocean and they've laid their eggs earlier this year. And now those eggs are incubating for a while in the river before turning into fry. But if the water temperatures get too warm, these eggs won't hatch. And the recent heat waves are causing these water temperatures to rise above the levels that they can survive. And the whole problem is being made worse by drought, which is affecting the whole state right now, and especially the area around the river. Just less water overall and making that water easier to be heated down to the bottom where the eggs are.
Of course, this extreme heat has us all thinking about climate change and the link between the two. And I understand there is a new study out about the urban contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. Tell us about that.
You know, we hear and talk a lot about federal policy and national commitments to reduce emissions, and those are important, of course, but cities can also have a big impact because most people who are alive today in the world are living in cities. So there's a new study out this week that gave us some interesting data on this. They looked at more than 160 cities worldwide and found that just 25 are responsible for more than half of all greenhouse gas emissions produced by all the cities that they looked at. And almost all of those 25 cities were in China. But they also looked at cities on a per capita basis. So how many emissions per person the cities emitted. And by that measure, some of the world's most polluting cities are right here in the U.S. Places like Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York City.
Wow, that is an interesting story. Let's talk about other environmental news. There was a new list of chemicals to keep an eye on, and it includes something new.
Right. Yes. The EPA announced on Monday that it was adding a family of synthetic chemicals known by the acronym PFAS to a list of wastewater contaminants that it was considering regulating. So these chemicals are used in all kinds of things to make them resistant to heat or water, stuff like fabrics and paint and cleaning products. There's thousands of different kinds. And they've been nicknamed forever chemicals because they don't break down in the environment and they can build up and accumulate in the body over time. But they aren't regulated currently in drinking water. There's no limit to how many of these chemicals can be in your water. So that's what the EPA indicated it was interested in doing by adding them to this draft list.
And we find these chemicals in flame retardants, nonstick coatings, and as you say, they're forever.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there was a study published last year that estimated as many as 80 million people in the U.S. might have PFAS in their drinking water. And the nonprofit Environmental Working Group also found it in rainwater and in almost all of the tap water that they tested across the country. So this draft is now open for, you know, public comment, and it may still be a few years before the list is finalized and any regulations are in place. So it's kind of a first step in a long process, but this is a step in that direction.
Let's turn to the ubiquitous COVID news. The pandemic, it appears, has evolved into two societies. And I mean those who are vaxxed and those who are not.
That's right, especially as the Delta variant takes hold. I mean, it's now responsible, as health officials predicted, for more than half of new COVID-19 cases diagnosed here in the U.S. And people who are fully vaccinated are well protected against this variant. But those who are unvaccinated or those who are only partially vaccinated and just got one dose of the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccines, they're at greater risk because this variant is more transmissible than the original one. So we're seeing increases in the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in places that have low vaccination rates. And virtually everyone who's been hospitalized or dying of COVID-19 now in the U.S. is unvaccinated.
And we do have cases of people who have been vaccinated and are hospitalized, but they are not in the high danger category.
Right. Yes. They're not as likely to die or have severe illness as those who are unvaccinated who are stricken with the Delta variant.
And it seems weird, I guess I'm using that word, pejoratively, to see that Tennessee has moved the dial backwards on its efforts to encourage kids to get vaccinated, and not just for COVID, but for all vaccines.
Yes, the state health department decided to really stop all of its outreach it was doing to teens to get them vaccinated, as you say, for COVID-19, but also for other things like HPV. And the top vaccine official in the state said this week that she was fired for trying to reach out to teens and encourage them to get the COVID-19 vaccine. You know, they were putting out public service ads to teens specifically and holding some of their vaccine events at schools. And it's no longer going to be doing any of that after being criticized by some Republican lawmakers.
Yeah, this seems like a purely political move.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, certainly not in the interest of public health, it would seem.
Let's talk about some hopeful COVID news. There's research into a kind of multi-antibody against all coronaviruses.
Right, yes. So scientists took antibodies that COVID-19 patients or people who had a similar virus had produced, and they tested them against all kinds of different coronaviruses. And they found one antibody that could bind to all different variants of COVID-19, as well as even to other coronaviruses, and which could potentially be useful in treating patients.
And so that's basically just basic research. We haven't, people are going to say, when can I get that vaccine, right? We're not even close to that yet.
Right. This was just an initial result that was reported. There'd still be a lot of steps to getting this, you know, approved as an actual treatment. There are a few antibody treatments out there already. So this could be another option to help patients who did get COVID-19 and are hospitalized to recover more quickly. This could be another option for them eventually.
You have a story this week about a group of ransomware hackers vanishing. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yeah. So ransomware is, it's a certain kind of attack where hackers remotely take control of your computer and demand a ransom to return access to you. And Patrick Hal O'Neill reported on this for us this week. There's a notorious gang of ransomware hackers who are believed to operate out of Russia or with Russia that has been responsible for a number of very large ransomware attacks in even just the last few months. But on Tuesday, they actually went dark. The websites and servers they'd used to run their criminal operation all went offline at around the same time. And security experts really don't know why, whether it was, you know, Russia cracking down or the US officials taking them offline or the group just deciding to, you know, give up, possibly go under the radar and reappear later. So we don't know exactly how long this will last or what was behind it. But in the short term, anyway, security experts were excited to see this happen.
Because President Biden said he told Putin to cut it out. I think he said it's something like, or else. So we don't know if Putin actually cut it out, meaning that he stopped the hackers or that something else happened.
Exactly. It's not yet clear yet what the cause is behind this group's removal or who was responsible. But yes, the U.S. has certainly been putting a lot more pressure on Russia and other countries as well to crack down on the cyber criminal gangs and circles operating within their borders.
A few weeks ago, we talked about the controversial Alzheimer's drug aducanumab, which was approved despite pushback from Alzheimer experts, and it also had a really serious price tag on it. This week, the FDA pulled back on that approval somewhat, and a few major medical centers said that they wouldn't plan on prescribing the drug. But you have a story about an Alzheimer's approach that may be even more helpful and a lot cheaper.
Absolutely. It's free, in fact, almost, or virtually. Yeah, there's been a lot of attention over the years on developing new pharmaceuticals for Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, of course. But new research published this week in Neurology showed the benefits of just keeping your mind active later in life as a way to fight against these diseases. So the analysis followed almost 2,000 older adults over a period of about 7 years, and they tracked how often these people did really simple activities, things like puzzles or reading a book or a magazine or certain kinds of games like chess or checkers. And they looked at whether there's an association between doing these activities and when people in the group developed Alzheimer's. And those who did them the most often, they found, which was like several times a week, developed symptoms on average of Alzheimer's 5 years later than those who did them the least often, which was just a few times a month. So there seemed to be a strong association here between doing these activities, you know, a few times a week and delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease.
And that is interesting because we always talk about anecdotal evidence about do puzzles, you know, try doing this with mind tricks. But this is really concrete evidence, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a very strong, robust study. And, you know, there's been evidence over the years that this might be, you know, a good thing to do. But this is the first time to really put a time to it. You know, how long does this help you delay these symptoms? And it really does seem to make a big difference.
Finally, I want to ask you about a study where slime mold is making decisions. Tell us about that.
Yes. So as it turns out, organisms that have no brains can still make decisions, according to a new study published this week by researchers at Harvard and Tufts University. The team grew a certain type of slime mold in a petri dish and arranged glass discs around the outside, and they found that the mold was growing in the same direction the vast majority of time, so toward where more of the discs were concentrated. And they think that certain ion channels in the mold have helped it detect the forces around it in its environment, like the strain created by these discs' weight, and decided to grow in that direction. So it's a pretty interesting situation where something without a brain can still make a decision and have a form of cognition.
So what was the slime mold looking for? Did somebody put bait like in a mouse trap or in a maze? What was the motivation for it making that decision?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, is there was no food available to it. There's no chemical signal in this experiment. It was just purely a physical force. So it was the weight and the distribution of these glass discs that it was attracted to. And the scientists I spoke with said that might, you know, have been kind of a proxy for what they might be looking for in the wild, like a log that was fallen over, or a tree or something that has a lot of mass that is distributed over a wide area. That's their theory anyway, as to why it moved toward the area where there were more of the discs concentrated.
So it had to make a choice which direction to grow, and it made a choice.
It did. It made a decision. It was, most of the times they tested it, it did the same thing. So it seemed to be a deliberate choice. Yeah, and a really interesting case of this organism making a decision in a way that we wouldn't typically think of decisions being made.
Well, I have to make a decision to end our conversation, although I wish we could go on, Amy. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
And some people have accused me of being sort of like a slime mold. Amy Nordstrom, commissioning editor at MIT's Technology Review. Always great to have her with us.